Welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio, and today's guest is W3JY Joseph Ames. He's the current chairman of the National Traffic Systems Eastern Area, staff and section manager for the ARRL's Eastern Pennsylvania section, and completing the balance of recently elected Atlantic officials. He is the Atlantic Division Vice Director. And, well, I'll tell you what, the list goes on. So let's get into this QSO and let's talk to Joe. Our guest is Joe Ames Jr., W3JY. And this fella has quite a background in amateur radio. And boy, I don't know if I could, I guess I'd be better off to come up with a list of things he hasn't done or a list of things he hasn't been involved in. He is, I'm going to let you kind of tell the folks what you're up to now, because it says here that you're the current chairman of the National Traffic Systems Eastern Area. And why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, good evening, Ted, and thank you very much for having me on tonight. I know the whole East Coast is under thunderstorm rain warnings here, so hopefully this will help pass the time for those of us who have a little leery of putting our antennas up on a front that goes several hundred miles across the whole country. So, well, the National Traffic System, of course, is alive and well, and I've been on the Eastern Area staff for a number of years, and this is my turn to serve as chairman of it. The chairman doesn't do a lot except moderate discussions and the cat fights, although honestly we don't have too many of those. It's a pretty collegial bunch of professionals, and I'm very happy about that. Of course, there are counterparts for the Central Area NTS and out in the Pacific Area, Rob Griffith and Steve Phillips, respectively. And they're very professional gentlemen, and they are very good leaders of the national traffic system out there in both their areas. And together we attempt to bring the ship of state forward and make sure that it's relevant to the early 21st century and beyond, as well as keep all of our existing operations going. So that's more or less what the NTS does at that level in a nutshell.
Well, let me ask a question, because we have a lot of new hams that tune in, and of course prospective hams that are shortwave listeners. But we have a lot of newbies. I mean, we're at Dayton. People are coming up to us all the time and say, hey, you know, we've been listening. You're the reason why we got our ticket and all that. Explain a little bit about the national traffic system. I always like to do this. I like to get in an area right on the ground floor where people a lot of times maybe are afraid to ask a question, or they're afraid to let someone know that they haven't got a clue as to what you're talking about.
I understand.
You know, let's talk about National Traffic System.
The National Traffic System goes to the very heart of the American Radio Relay League, Ted. And although as a system, it was invented by George Hart, who used to be, back in the day, he was the communications manager for our league in 1949, George really did nothing more than formalize quite a lot that had been learned about how to send radiogram messages across the United States and into Canada and even into Europe and South America, thanks to all the advancements that were made during World War II in network science and the technology of how networks operate. And some of his thinking was very forward-looking for the time. And essentially he came up with a hub-and-spoke model that replaced all the old trunk lines, as they called them, where iron traffic men would sit at their keys and send radiogram messages into the wee hours of the morning as long as propagation supported it, and turned it into a hierarchical system that we've had for the past 60 years and still works very well. Now, I also recognize quite a lot of our new amateurs may not even know what a radiogram is, but they probably have heard of telegrams from the Western Union men and, you know, old period pieces and movies and whatnot. And so a radiogram is as old as radio. It's the founding cause, of course, for the American Radio Relay League, which was founded to organize in 1914 better ways of sending radiograms, which, of course, were nothing more than a wireless version of the telegrams that had been in use at that point for a very, very long time, certainly before this war between the states, going to the 1830s when Samuel Morse first tapped out "What hath God wrought" with his telegraph invention. And so radiograms were a way of sending instant messages back in the day. And well, a fun little thing I enjoy telling you know, younger hams or prospective hams is how they very favorably compare to a Twitter tweet. And if you look even at the underlying code, there's much similarity on them. So the National Traffic System operates 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, sending radiogram messages back and forth throughout the United States and Canada, and recently even into Europe and Germany particularly, and Great Britain, and from points there to other countries within the European Union who have caught the radiogram bug in the last couple of years. We operate on many different modes. Of course, we have our traditional voice circuits, and there are still quite a few Morse code nets out there. And I got to tell you, Ted, there's nothing more beautiful than listening to a Morse net in operation with the skilled operators. They're so economical in their transmissions and their code. It's very highly orchestrated. You might even say choreographed, and it's just a thing of beauty. And, of course, for the last number of years, we've had the digital version of the NTS. We call it NTSD, NTS Digital, and it is a fully automated and fully automated, but supplemented with semi-automated and even manual interconnects, primarily on HF, using HF PAC-TOR circuits, that can relay messages transcontinentally in the matter of about an hour or so. And that's a very important part of our emergency infrastructure. Between all the various modes that we have, there are several thousand messages that are sent this way every month. And you know, just to kind of preempt it, yes, we've lost a lot of business because of ubiquitous email and you know, cheap wireless national calling plans, but we're still out there, and we practice, and we keep our circuits alive and our skills sharp and our stations robust and operating so that should worse come to worst, we're ready for health and welfare messages or even emergency messaging from our federal government or state governments who might one day rely on us.
Well, you know, when I was younger, I remember the traffic nets seemed to be, I don't know if I want to say, well, yeah, more active. They were more active than they are now. And people were actually passing traffic in routine messages. And some of the time, the messages were just exactly that, just very routine. Let me just give an example. Maybe a happy birthday, you know, to a relative somewhere. You know, say you had an aunt or uncle in Cincinnati, so you'd send the message that way, you know, and some ham would pick up the phone and call them up and deliver the message that had been given to him on the national traffic system. But I think now about a snowstorm we had here in the Nashville area. This has been maybe, well, it hasn't been that long ago, maybe 2 or 3 years, I don't know, 2 years. And every cell phone was useless. I mean, they were just paperweights. They just turned into nothing, you know. They didn't work. And there was snow on the ground. And in Tennessee, woohoo, that's something else, man.
Yes.
You go to the grocery store, you're not going to find eggs, you're not going to find milk, and you're not going to find bread. And that's because as soon as someone says snow, people run, they grab those items, come home, and they start making French toast. At least that's what I figure. But what was cool, what I think what folks don't realize, and especially new hams, there needs to be some sort of an awakening in this, and that is that the national traffic system is still there.
Yes.
So if there were an earthquake, say, for example, God forbid, on the East Coast, and all of the emergency vehicles, all the emergency services are tied up and everybody's, you know, how do you find out if your aunt and uncle are still there? How do you find out what the, you know, and the national traffic system, believe it or not, can get messages through in areas and times like that because that's what hams specialize in. And I think that a lot of times our national traffic system is kind of overlooked and maybe even thought of as a bit little, you know, like antiquated. But there could be nothing from the truth. This is really and truly the bare bones, most reliable way in order to communicate back and forth across the country, especially during some sort of a compromise situation. Now, just shoot at me if I'm wrong here.
No, Ted, in fact, of course, I agree with you. And I want to amplify on that a little bit because the national traffic system is, first of all, it's a system. And that means it's filled with operators. We run ourselves professionally. In other words, we monitor our own processes and procedures. We schedule and run our own nets. We have discipline and quality control built into the system. And you have several thousand very serious, very well-educated people who are involved in this, and they've dedicated their lives to it, and often many, many thousands of dollars in equipment, amplifiers, robust antennas, high-grade transceivers, because that's all, just like a contester, critical to doing this on HF, you know, given the vagaries of the band. And what motivates us is a sense of public service. I think it's maybe more of a quiet professional who just does his thing behind the scenes, like the Maytag repairman. But yes, the national traffic system in all of its flavors is not antiquated. My academic and professional background is in organizations and systems and how they interact with each other. And I can tell you from being out there as a practitioner for organizational diagnoses at the largest companies in the world, many with government and NGO missions, that the national traffic system as a communications vehicle is as good as anything that's been developed since, because it uses foundational principles of the network. It is, at the same time, hierarchical and structured, and yet has the flexibility because of the skill and professionalism and just, you know, flat-out ingenuity of the operators who know this like the back of their hands to route around parts of the system that have been damaged or are out of service. And so in that regard, you might even think that it was an internet before the internet, a self-healing system, using human intelligence to reroute circuits and make sure that messages get through. And that has been carried through into our digital variant, which is, I think it's fair to describe it as a hybrid mesh network. It's not a true mesh network in that sense that a IT professional might think, but it has built-in redundancies and the ability to use and switch to alternate delivery routes automatically based on criteria that we can place into it. And so the national traffic system, in effect, in all of its flavors, which are fully interoperable with each other, so a message can go from voice to digital to CW back to voice for delivery on a telephone or a courier, is a system that does not depend on commercial infrastructure. It does not use the internet. It does not use government comms infrastructure. We have these conversations with emergency managers up and down from Washington, D.C., all the way down to our local townships, and that's one of the things they like about it most, because it uses only the ionosphere. It's decentralized, and the operators are skilled and know their local area and the equipment that they have, and it gives them the ability to fall back to whatever it takes to make it work. And if for some reason a section fails or a station goes off the air, we can reroute around it intelligently as ham radio operators that understand propagation and understand when the circuit is down. And so when we put all this together, Ted, and think about it, the NTS has been doing things that, you know, Twitter is doing now commercially, obviously for an audience of, you know, hundreds of millions of people, but requires a very expensive infrastructure to get done. We offer that same conceptual level of communications, but we think of it as, I guess maybe we all fantasize as the guys there in that science fiction show from years ago where they had to repel the alien invasion using Morse code messaging. I forget the name of the movie now, but yep, we see that day coming through, and frankly, a lot of people recognize that as well, in government and without. We're not sexy anymore, maybe, but you know, what's old is new again. And I have my boys are in the scout movement. They're young boys, and I got to tell you, they just love Morse code and sitting there tapping it out. So, you know, there's a kind of an innate thrill to getting a radiogram, even if it's you know, kind of a generic one about a birthday greeting. And that helps keep our circuits going until such time as they may be necessary. And we're hoping that it will increase our public visibility. There are always efforts ongoing to do that and to revitalize it, so it's a renewing thing. It goes through ups and downs, of course. But essentially, we all recognize that the national traffic system is a vital skill set, and we can't lose it. We cannot lose the network. We cannot lose the skills and savvy that go into operating radio nets, particularly the manual nets, which would be a skill that would be tough to recreate from scratch, that the radiogram form is honed to perfection for HF messaging purposes with its network management and audit trail information that's built into it. The size is perfect for tough conditions. And that's how we see it. That's how we keep going on a day-to-day basis, Ted. And essentially, that's what we see as our value proposition to our country. And we do, of course, hope that this is kept up and that people recognize it.
Well, you know, here in our area, I realize there is there's amateur radio inside of the EOCs all over Tennessee, wherever the Emergency Operations Center is. There's generally a ham there and a transceiver for HF and even for VHF communications. Now, my question is this, and this shows my stupidity, so I'm a little, I know. Is the national traffic system set up so that these various EOCs all over the country could use it for traffic management? In other words, if an emergency center in Chicago, Illinois, the normal lines of communication are down, and they want to send vital information to Atlanta, Georgia, can that be done? Is the NTS set up like that? I'm just curious.
The answer is yes and no. And since our heyday back in the 1980s and early 1990s, before the internet obviously disrupted us, that infrastructure was in place and largely operational. Today, we do have the backbone of it. The NTS system itself persists. Our section nets, our regional nets, our eastern area, central and Pacific area nets, the transcontinental core is still there to get the messages back and forth. Honestly, our weakest link at this point would be what we call the last mile. And we call this the divergence of NTS and ARIES. And it really got off in earnest after September 11th, of course, when the national security effort took front and center, understandably so. And the need for long-haul communications wasn't necessarily considered as important as the ability to deal with local terrorist attacks or local responses by the emergency management personnel.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSO Radio Show. We'll be back with our guest, W3JY Joseph Ames, right after this. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from C-Crane. You need to go to the C-Crane website, ccrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the C-Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you get a special bonus. Now, you be sure and do that. Check out this little radio, the SkyWave from the C-Crane Company. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20. For like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com.
Let's talk just for a moment about QSL cards. And let me tell you about Mr. QSL. Call sign K4JSG. The world's finest QSL cards ever guaranteed. Now, if you go up on this guy's website, you're going to find this note that says, please note, these are custom design cards. If you're looking for a plain, ordinary, simple, basic, or any other word that's a synonym for boring, you'll be better off with a different card maker. Now, somebody make a statement like that, that should tell you something. The world's finest QSL cards ever guaranteed, K4JSG. Go to Google, put in Mr. QSL. That's Mr. QSL. The very first listing will be Mr. QSL or K4JSG.com.
Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com.
Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there. And other information, but go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website, it's simply QSORadioShow.com, and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening.
You're listening to the QSL Radio Show. And now, back to our guest, Joseph Ames, W3JY.
And so, what we have here is a is a hodgepodge. We have some sections, in fact, quite a few sections, maybe a third of the country or a little more, that have very robust linkages between NTS and their local ARIES units that, of course, would carry the messaging into their state and county EOCs. On other sections, it's maybe not as good. Some sections eschew NTS entirely at the pleasure of the section manager and his cabinet staff. And there's not a lot we can do about that. However, we do maintain the section nets in all the 83 sections of the United States and Canada. So the infrastructure is there. The linkages are not always there. But in a number of sections, for example, down in Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland, is the Maryland, D.C. people, Jim Cross, WI3N's section, and Al Nomeyer, W3YVQ, who's their section traffic manager, and also up in Connecticut with Betsy Doan, they have very robust linkages between their ARIES personnel at the county or town level and their national traffic system. And in fact, they have quite a lot of the NTSD capability there as well. They drill it. They practice it. It's part of their state and county emergency guidance from the professional side of the house. They understand what amateurs are capable of doing, and it's there, and they do it. And we find that in numerous other sections. In New Jersey, for the most part, North and South New Jersey is set up that way. Large parts of New York State are working on that. New York City, I'm not sure about. I think that's largely professional, but they have a healthy respect for what hams can do. Pennsylvania is pretty good. Pennsylvania has a very strong relationship with the state EMA, and I know they're building capability to do that. There's quite a lot of cross-pollination because, frankly, Ted, what has happened is that as we move away from the horrible events on September 11th, we recognize that there are other problems as well. Here in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic area especially, we got nailed by Hurricane Sandy a couple years ago. Some communities are still recovering from that. At the time the storm hit, two things happened. First of all, the original track would have taken it right through the colonial part of Pennsylvania, which is heavily wooded, older development. For example, the power lines and most utility infrastructure is above ground. And the trees are very thick, in that part of the country. They haven't had a hurricane, a strong hurricane, in decades. And essentially, what the state governor recognized and the EMA people is that if that storm had come across Pennsylvania, it's possible they'd still be digging out from it today because, it hadn't been culled by other storms. And so it went up through New Jersey instead. New Jersey and coastal New York, of course, get hit by hurricanes and strong nor'easters all the time. And we still see the devastation that was wrought. And there was a story in Emergency Management Magazine, which is a nice, big, glossy, coffee table-type magazine you see at a EOC. And essentially, it was a small beach town in North New Jersey somewhere. I forget exactly where, but it was essentially visited by FEMA personnel, and then they forgot about them. And fortunately, there was a woman who was there who had a smartphone and quite a bit of spunk, and she corralled a couple of the local men and learned how to take car batteries out of cars that were stranded, out of gas. And she used her smartphone as an ad hoc communication center, a command post for them, if you will, a message center. And it was her only outside contact to the New Jersey EMA people and to their loved ones for a week or two. I forget the exact number of days, but let's just say a number of days, and she would rotate car batteries in and out to power her smartphone and do this service. And, of course, it's a shame ham radio wasn't there, but, of course, that area got walloped so hard they had their own problems. And it points to the need of something like an NTS to supplement local responders, even amateur radio responders with the ARIES, to step in there and pick up the slack. So those are the kind of questions that we're recognizing are appropriate to today's communication needs, and we find that there's something of a congruence going on, like a coalescence of thinking. We hear this more from emergency managers at the federal and the state levels, that NTS has a role. We've been approached by a number of defense-related national security corporations that have a need for robust transcontinental communications for their own purposes. You know, you can imagine military contractors and whatnot that produce equipment and aviation companies. And so what they have been looking to is a means to supplement their own commercial-based communications using their in-house ham clubs for that emergency message that they might have to get out if, again, if worse comes to worse and they have a catastrophe, you know, and the internet is down maybe from a cyber attack or a, you know, cable is ruptured or something like that. So yes, the need for it is there. Of course, we, the operators of NTS, and I've been doing it, you know, since I was a teenager way back when, so you know, I know this stuff like the back of my hand from having done it for decades of my life. We are coming together and finding a way to make NTS survive and thrive in the coming years, and we're hopeful that younger operators will just enjoy it for the thrill of talking to real people as delivery agents for our radiograms. We find there's a real thrill for that, too, and I deliver radiograms to people. Sometimes they'll just chat my ear off, you know, many times I'm the first hand that's talked to them, and they love it.
But what a incredible, I guess I want to say, witness for ham radio. In other words, you show up to deliver a message, or you call on the phone, or however the message is being delivered, you are now the ambassador for this hobby.
Yes.
To someone who knows very little, maybe even nothing about it.
Yes, and with the, you know, and, you know, when you and I got licensed, you know, we would study with our local club over an extended period of months, maybe. And, of course, there was only HF to speak of, you know, back in the good old days. And so we were mentored along through our licenses. You know, we'd take our novice test, you know, usually with the club or, you know, at least, you know, through club people who would take us down to the FCC field office. And they would be our first group of friends, plus our classmates. You know, there'd be, you know, the camaraderie of our classmates who maybe went to school with us, you know, or from our community. And so we would have radio friends at the same time, and we'd be initiated into a larger radio community. And it doesn't work like that anymore. You know, obviously, you know, at least in my neck of the woods here in southeastern Pennsylvania, you know, the ham and a day sessions are very popular. You know, they're very effective. We find a lot of people coming in, you know, mid-career professionals who have an interest in ham radio. Maybe they're EMA people who want to get, to take advantage of the more robust communications that amateur radio offers them compared to their public service radios, or maybe they're preppers, you know, or just, you know, adults who wanted to do this way back when but never got around to it. But the fact of the matter is, they have their own community and their own social world set up, and they find that it's hard to get involved and integrated with the local scene. They're not really sure where to go. So if I happen to send one of the, you know, our wonderful welcome to amateur radio, congratulations on your new license messages to them, yes, I am an ambassador, and I may, very well may be the first person they've talked to since their test, and can help help walk them through. And I'm very gratified that, in fact, just last week I visited the local meeting here at the Marple Newtown Amateur Radio Club, and in the back of the room was a lady who was in my wife's licensing class, and you know, I had to spend some time talking with her. Her husband and her son are still licensed and still active, and they joined this club, and they're active in the club and active in their communities as ham radios, because, you know, we took that interest and, you know, and just welcomed them in. So the Elmer, or the mentor aspect of it too, cannot be underestimated, and frankly, they like it. Their kids like it. And, you know, they say, I enjoy mailing them a radiogram for them, and I oftentimes get a handwritten letter back saying how much they got a kick out of seeing the radiogram for them. So there's just sort of a neat kind of, steampunk, kind of retro cool element to it that we see catching on with the younger folks.
Well, you know, I listen to phone nets sometimes. Well, we have our Tennessee phone net on 3980, you know, and I listen to those guys check in, and invariably it's they check in and they say, any traffic, no traffic, any traffic, no traffic, any traffic, no traffic.
Right.
You know,
right.
And I was thinking to myself, let's make something up.
Yeah.
let's let's say happy birthday to somebody. Let's send something to somebody, you know. And I sit and listen to that, and I wonder, there's several things I want to talk about in relationship to this. But, do the guys that are on these nets, do they look at it like if you're sending a piece of routine information that it's boring to them, or they just don't want to fool with it unless it's an actual emergency or a situation? Or are people like me kind of like nothing but a migraine headache? In other words, let's do something for the fun of it. How does that fall out there?
Well, as you know, amateur radio has a very diverse population of people who come here with many different motivations and different personalities, and you know, they find themselves and people of like mind on the air. And so what we see is that our nets do fall out into a couple different personalities. By and large, I think routine traffic of that nature is highly welcomed. Again, here in eastern Pennsylvania, in my section, that traffic is welcome. We have the section net where we send out congratulatory radiograms to people who accomplish something, perhaps passing a test, maybe our ARRLEC001 exam, or who are appointed to a position in the field organization, or, for example, we had a ham who was named American Red Cross Volunteer of the Year, along with his XYL in his community. And so we'll use radiograms to send a personal congratulatory note to them. We also use it for section business with our station activity reports. And a lot of stuff that's kind of by default migrated over to email or cell phones, we're making a conscious effort to use our own networks. And it was a little strange at first, I think. People had been so long, they didn't really know what to make of it, but it's caught on. And the Eastern Pennsylvania Emergency Phone and Traffic Net, which is our version of the Tennessee Net, Tom, AF4NC, is the net manager over in just north of Philly. He tells us that attendance and participation in that net has nearly trebled since we've started sending, kind of routine messages like that back and forth amongst ourselves. And that's just, wonderful news, and it shows, what can happen if you just start doing it. Now, on the other hand, of course, we do get reports here and there of, various sections. Of course, these are always very vague reports, and we wonder if they're not urban legends, it's like citing Elvis or, the underground bunkers beneath Colorado Airport or Denver Airport or something. But we hear these stories of sections that have banned, the bulk traffic that's out there, and they'll only take, certain kinds of messages. But I have a hard time substantiating that. But I do think that maybe some of the old-timers have... it's been so long since I've heard, real radiogram traffic. Maybe they just don't quite know what to make of it.
I know you've just lost me. The underground bunkers in Denver underneath the airport, which is... part of the concentration camps that all of us Americans will be placed in for obtaining a ham license. You're talking about what kind of traffic? Somehow you lost me there.
Oh, no. I was saying the reports we've heard of section nets that won't take routine radiograms, we think that maybe they're urban legends like that.
Okay. All right.
We can't confirm or substantiate. We have these very fuzzy photographs of scowling section traffic managers, but no one will own up to it when we push the issue.
Well, I didn't know, because we got Art Bell coming back on our shortwave station here.
And, I love listening to Art Bell. He was one of the first radio talk shows I heard as a kid. He goes way back to the 70s, if I'm not mistaken.
I know out on the West Coast he was big, but I don't know when he just actually got started, but he goes back a ways. But he's starting with us here on WTWW, and I think it's incredible, because one of the things that man has done, and that is, he has really promoted this hobby. He lets everybody know that he's a ham, and when he's on the air, and you can go on there and talk to him and whatnot, and it's I like that. But we're getting off beaten path. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSL Radio Show. We'll be back with our guest, W3JY, Joseph Ames, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20. For like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you get a special bonus. You be sure and do that. Check out this little radio, the SkyWave from the Sea Crane Company. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's theunseenbean.com. That's theunseenbean.com. Let's talk just for a moment about QSL cards. And let me tell you about Mr. QSL, call sign K4JSG. The world's finest QSL cards ever guaranteed. Now, if you go up on this guy's website, you're going to find this note that says, please note, these are custom design cards. If you're looking for a plain, ordinary, simple, basic, or any other word that's a synonym for boring, you'll be better off with a different card maker. Now, somebody make a statement like that, that should tell you something. The world's finest QSL cards ever guaranteed, K4JSG. Go to Google. Go to Google, put in Mr. QSL. That's Mr. QSL. The very first listing will be Mr. QSL or K4JSG.com. Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. And now, back to our guest, Joseph Ames, W3JY. I want you to, if you would, describe to me, because we've got... You would not believe we have this group out there that's called Ham Test Online, and these guys have it down to a science. I mean, I've not seen anything like this before. So we have a lot of new people that are coming on board, and I know one of the problems that the new folks have is, first off, they don't quite know how to operate. I mean, they're a little intimidated to that. And they've heard all about this ham radio stuff, and they want to get involved. They understand that, you know, hams do things during emergencies and all that kind of stuff. So we have this new group, and so one of the things I think that is our responsibility is to fill them in. A lot of them listen to the QSO show. So what I'd like for you to do is describe the national traffic system. And the reason why I say this is because I know there's nets that are on. I mean, I hear things like, like Midcars is a good example.
Right.
I hear them on the air. I don't know if there's a West Cars, if there's a South Cars. I mean, I've listened to Midcars. I find it really interesting tuning into these nets. And I participate in the Tennessee phone net here whenever I'm near a radio. And how does it all break down? Because it seems like there's sections. But then I was curious as to, you know, how do you tie the sections together and how does it all come out in the end?
Sure. And first I would like to just shout out for Ham Test Online. My oldest boy, who's a Cub Scout, is using that. And he's learning quite a lot from them. So they're good. And so it actually works. I can tell you from my own experience.
Well, I mean, I've got friends of mine that could not put batteries in a flashlight.
Yes.
You know, get the positive and the negative correct, you know, have no, and they wind up getting the technician test in 2 weeks. And then they really understand a good portion of what they're studying. But go ahead.
Okay, so the National Traffic System is a network of nets. Now, for new amateurs, when we say net, and we put that word around there, it's a little bit different from what you might expect from hearing, you know, the net, meaning the internet. But, you know, it comes from the same basic root, and it means if you were to draw all these stations out on a map, it would look like a fishing net with all these interconnections between the stations, or in IT, you know, lingo, of course, nodes. And so the nets operate at various different levels, at the local level. Usually on a county or a city, maybe on a metropolitan area, where you have just a rag chew net, you know, a net where people talk, and then they may or may not pass traffic, or maybe they just keep themselves company during drive time within a metropolitan area. But they come together at a specific time on a specific frequency or a repeater, and they talk and they send information back and forth. Most of them are at least nominally affiliated with our national traffic system, and their net control operators and the regulars are capable of taking a formal radiogram should they need to. And so that's our basic level, and we count on them in a number of areas for delivering these radio messages. But the next level higher than that is almost always what we call the section level, and the section is a state or a portion of a state that's divided for administrative purposes In the American Radio Relay League, the section is their basic unit of management, and they have a section manager, and they have section traffic managers and section emergency coordinators, and the whole ARRL is organized around the section. And so the section net typically is a national traffic system net, and they will take traffic from local nets that is percolating up, and they'll take traffic from the next higher echelon, which is the region net. Region net coincides for the most part with the FCC call districts. So we have a first region net. We call it a FRN for first instead of a one. But we have a 2RN for the second call area. So New York and New England are covered. 3RN covers the Mid-Atlantic area, Pennsylvania, Maryland, D.C., and Delaware. And 4LAND is covered by the fourth region net. That's a gigantic area, of course, because it's the entire southeast. And it's a very busy net. And the net control stations who run the daily nets and the net manager are consummate professionals with what they do in keeping that net operating. They move a lot of traffic.
Okay, now I'm going to interrupt you here for a second. Where does the Tennessee phone net, the Alabama net, and all of those fit in? I'm not aware of the Kentucky net. There may be one. But I'm saying, right. Like, for example, the Tennessee phone net, and I know there's an Alabama phone net because I hear them on. I hear a Wolverine net, which I assume is up in Michigan somewhere. How do those fit in to these nets here you're talking about?
Typically, they would be considered a section net that covers a state or a portion of a state. Some of those I know for a fact are affiliated with the national traffic system. Some are more informally affiliated. And, some come and go. We have quite a few independent nets that are welcome to affiliate with the national traffic system. Midwest cars, mid cars and E cars and South cars, they are affiliates of our national traffic system. There's the hit and bounce net that meets, it's a Morse code based net. They have a high speed and a slow speed version. They move a lot of traffic. And they're an independent net that's affiliated. And so all these nets can elect based on, the desire of the membership, whether they want to participate in this or not. Most do, at least to some extent. Some don't, and some come and go. But here's where the Internet really has helped propagate the information about this. The American Radio Relay League's home site has a net directory online where you can search for nets in your area based on your city or your ARRL membership and the section that you belong to or affiliate with, and you can select the national traffic system as one of the little choices you have on there. Of course, there are a number of other nets that operate for other purposes. We try to stay on friendly terms with them. But essentially, the state nets or the section nets percolate up to the regional nets, and membership in the region nets is restricted to formally designated liaison stations. And these are very efficient. They'll come in with a stack of traffic, and they'll send it to their counterparts wherever it's headed. Usually it goes all the way to the area net, which would encompass from Maine all the way down to Key West. So you're looking Bay of Fundy and up on the St. Lawrence River, straight down there into the Gulf, and over to the border I think Alabama is in the eastern area. Louisiana would be part of the central area, and typically along the Mississippi River, it would be the eastern area, and the central and Pacific areas have their own thing, and so. At those nets that meet maybe a couple of times a day, and by the way, region nets may meet a couple of times a day to give opportunities for propagation and for expeditious moving of traffic. And traffic, by the way, means a radiogram. So the eastern area, the central area, and the Pacific area nets collect the traffic that's going their way, and there they have what's called the transcontinental core. And this goes right back 100 years ago to the very earliest days of Hiram Percy Maxim and the Iron Men who would sit up at all hours of the night, usually high school boys, as you can imagine, or college boys, and they would transmit these messages on prearranged schedules with the counterpart. And it's very complex, very professional. They have different cycles. They have an A cycle and a B cycle and a C cycle and a D cycle for each of their schedules. And they may have 60 or 80 of these cycles a month that they have schedules with their counterparts, and they send this traffic out. It's almost inevitably, invariably sent using Morse So it's high-speed CW, and these are the creme de la creme of our operator corps, and they send thousands of messages, even this day, across the continental United States and into Canada. And then it goes right back down again from the transcontinental corps to its destination area nets, from there down to its section or state nets, depending on what's going on in that locality. And from there, either directly delivered, if the delivery operators check into the section net, or it'll be passed to the local nets, and those are usually county-level ARIES nets that meet once or twice a week. And the digital system is parallel to this. It's not a replacement. It operates in parallel. Messages can come in and out of the digital system at any point, and you know, to continue their journey based on the decision of the system operators at any given part of that. And that is the national traffic system. You might recognize that that's how Federal Express is organized. And
for all you folks that are listening that are not following this completely, don't feel bad, because I'm not either.
it's a lot. It's a very advanced system, Ted, and that's something that we try to tell even our own ARRL colleagues who, you know, aren't really quite sure what to make of NTS, if they, you know, newish hams in the last 15, 20 years even. We tell them that this is essentially that story you've heard where the Harvard Business School rejected the business plan for Federal Express. And in a way, he just reinvented the national traffic system, but for airplanes and packages instead of radio operators and telegram, you know, radiograms. And it was cutting edge when FedEx did it. It was cutting edge when George Hart and N1NJM invented this back in 1949. And it's still a very sophisticated model today. And the nice thing is, Ted, it's been honed to perfection over the years. You know, everything that could possibly go wrong with this model has gone wrong and been addressed by some very dedicated, very smart operators over the years. And we are very glad to be their inheritors, you know, of that legacy. And basically, we want to do everything we can to keep the national traffic system alive and well for the next 100 years, in whatever form that might take, whatever technology that might take, because we recognize that there is a need for it, that even with the most robust telecommunications infrastructure, at some point it won't work, because it's a thing that's made by man, and man-made things break. And we want to be there when that happens and serve our neighbors and our communities and our nation when that happens.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, what strikes me, the first thing that hits me, is when you talk about these very professional high-speed CW operators passing hundreds of pieces of traffic, what goes through my mind is, hey, you know what? They're going unnoticed, because I think most people, like myself, have no idea this is even going on.
That is true.
This needs to be something brought to the forefront and brought up to the point where every amateur radio operator in the U.S. is aware that this is going on and understand what it all means. Because this is obviously part of the justification of this hobby, is the fact that we're able to do these things. And I hear this. I had no idea that NTS was that honed down, that sophisticated, and being run by people who were really professional in what they're doing. I mean, you know, and I hate the term radio amateur. I don't know. I've hated it ever since I first heard it. You know, I feel better about ham than I do than I do radio amateur, because really, when you get right down to it, inside our ranks are some of the most professional, profound people that have explored all sorts of and exploited new technologies and things to the point where the general public isn't even aware of it. Now, here, we suffer from two things very similar to shortwave radio. And let me draw this comparison, okay? We have this group of people, quite a huge group of people now, that listen to shortwave.
Yes.
Okay, now, there's another group of people here in the United States that are completely and totally unaware of this large group. Now, when I had heard that the Texan radio company had made the claim they were making like 30,000 shortwave radios a day, okay, and I thought that was just a fabrication or a misplaced decimal. I had a long conversation with them, and
indeed they are making that many radios. They go everywhere under the sun. They go throughout China. Right. There's a lot of Chinese folks listening to shortwave. A lot of them that live way out from the big cities. And there's nothing there other than their international shortwave national station, you know, that the government broadcasts to. And, of course, they like to listen to broadcasts coming from the United States like this one, you know. And I asked the gentleman at Texan, I said, well, should we be broadcasting in Mandarin or Cantonese or something? And he said, no. He said, a lot of these folks are wanting to learn English. He said, you need to speak slowly and limit the vocabulary because they'll listen to you. And I thought, that's just so incredible, you know. And but anyway, as we look here in the U.S., there is, you know, back, let me go back to, I don't know, do you remember Willis Conover years ago on The Voice of America doing the jazz show?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Okay.
I played saxophone when I was a boy. That show.
All right, well, here's the thing. The BBC estimated back then that Willis Conover had about 30 million people listening on shortwave when he was on. Okay, now back then, shortwave radios sat on desktops, and they had tubes in them, okay? Today, we've got these little radios. I've got one here that would blow your mind from the Sea Crane Company that they sent here. It's called a Skywave. It fits in the palm of your hand. It's based on DSP technology. This thing is scary. I mean, without a big, long antenna, you know, I sit in my backyard, and I'm pulling in all kinds of DX stations I'm hearing in the palm of my hand. Of course, now, if you're listening to a 100-kilowatt blowtorch like this one, you have no trouble getting it anywhere. I mean,
right.
In the house, wherever you're at, it comes
right.
In. Mine plays in the car going down the road, okay? But there, once again, now, with the portable radios, the Grundig Yacht Boys, the Sanjeans, and all these smaller radios that run on batteries with a whip antenna, some of them, if you attach an antenna to them, you overload the front end because they're purposely designed to be ultra-sensitive. There's a group of people, a huge group of people, listening to shortwave radio domestically in the United States as well as around the world. But the numbers are shockingly high. Now, the rest of the country, though, apart from this group, seems to be totally separated from them. They don't even know they're there.
Yes,
and
that's an interesting problem.
You know, so now you go to talk to those folks, and you say shortwave radio, and they look at you with they look like a cow looking at a new gate. Okay, they don't have any idea what you're talking about. So you start talking, and it used to be you could say Voice of America, you could say Radio Free Europe, and all of a sudden they would go, oh yeah, I know what that is. Okay. They don't do that today. Today they have no idea what Radio Free Europe was, and they have absolutely no idea what the Voice of America was, so or is, or anything else. So this is a whole new media. Now, we have this influx of new hams coming in on the scene, and I would bet money, if I had some money to bet, okay, that the majority of them have not a clue as to what the national traffic system is.
No, you're absolutely right, and that's something that we recognize. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that I was tapped to chair up the Eastern Area staff just this year. I do have a background in sales and marketing from my early career and some of my graduate education, and this is a perfect example of the need for competing in a very busy marketplace. Essentially. Hams are not good salesmen, and they're so competent in their discipline, and they're rewarded for their competency in their day jobs and as amateurs amongst ourselves. They really do think if you build it, they will come. You know, build a better mousetrap, and the world will be the path to your doorstep. Unfortunately, that is true as far as it goes. Unfortunately. Everyone else who's building different and cheaper mousetraps is advertising it. And so we're losing quite a lot of people that could very likely love ham radio but never find out about it because we're not telling our own story.
But let me say this. Right now, you take a young person who knows nothing about the NTS. Okay, now all of a sudden, they learn about it and decide that they want to engage in this. Okay, now think about this challenge. That we can send a message across the country and deliver it without the internet.
Right.
See, that challenge in itself, I would think, is motivation to say, yeah, hey, you know what? I want to get in the middle of this. This sounds like something cool. But they've got to know about it. Somehow they have to find out. And that's one of the things we're doing right now.
And I must tell you, on behalf of the entire National Traffic System, we are very grateful for this exposure because WTWW is a blowtorch station, and I know, because I listen to it, that it has an audience that goes around the world, and quite a lot here in the United States. I know that for a fact, because everything you just said, I've seen in my own experience. And so what do we have?
Well, you know, I think, and not to interrupt you again, but I think a young person can find purpose and direction and can find a reason ultimately to turn on his radio or her radio and say, hey, this is part of my responsibility. I get to use my radio to do this. I don't know. I just think that's fantastic. And I think it could be a really big drawing card for younger people who want to get involved in this hobby, but they want to feel like what they're doing is useful.
Yes, because there's the personal challenge of doing it on their own with their own effort, which the internet doesn't provide you anymore, and the internet has lost its sheen in that regard. You know, it truly is an appliance and a utility right now. It's not not alluring in the way it was in 1995 or something when it was a wide open field. But we see that here in our local clubs and in our Aries groups and with our Boy Scout outreach efforts. We see that the youngsters recognize the inherent challenge of radio. They like that. They like the fact, of course, that it's private amongst themselves, you know, and so there are all sorts of many different elements of excitement that go into ham radio once they're introduced to it. And so what we're trying to understand now is how best to do that. Now, you know, for various reasons, some I understand, some I don't. You know, even our own ARRL has not seen in their infinite wisdom to promote us very much in the last 25 or 30 years since George Hart retired. Yeah. And so, you know, in fact, in the most recent Aries manual, you know, we were a little disappointed. There wasn't much to say about us in there, you know, but we're taking that as a challenge. And so we are actively promoting the idea that the NTS is in fact the elder brother of the emergency response. And so Boy Scouts love that. It's part of their you know, their skill set for independent living and for being prepared. We see that the kids love it because it's something they can make themselves. You can still make crystal radio and pick up clear channel stations or your local AM broadcast station during the daytime. And for that matter, stations like the one that we're on right now that are receivable in very simple equipment. And that gives a sense of pride in the youngster that is not available elsewhere. It's hard to get something comparable to that today just because of the way things are when everything is done for them or it's there for the taking. The other thing we're trying to do is to go back to our history and to our traditions and revisit them because there is, you know, I won't even call it nostalgia, but there is a definite market need that people have for things before the internet, before September 11th, when the world made sense and it was simple and it was graspable. You know, you turn on the radio and you hear Walter Cronkite, or not Walter Cronkite, but he did actually have a radio broadcast for his news stories, if I'm not mistaken. But you know, you heard that and it brought order to your world. We think that we can tap into that sense. We see it happening. We're getting younger operators who are interested in our clubs locally. I have to tell you, they don't all go to the National Traffic System, but you know, they're coming to our clubs here with that as the draw. What we're trying to do is to make sure that at least our amateur radio community knows that the NTS is here, that we're doing these good things. We're getting the word out to emergency managers and our NGO partners. You know, so the message is becoming loud and clear. We're finding within the organization of the league itself quite a few of the current crop of directors are interested in the NTS, and that bodes well, because if they're interested in it, of course, you know, the headquarters staff is interested in it, naturally. And so, you know, we hope that that will improve our visibility, even within our own ranks. And for external, you know, we find ourselves talking about and actually doing things like showing up at county fairs again with a radiogram booth in the corner. You know, it's so old, it's new again, and it's fun. We have a ham here who's very active in the Chester County Aries Races group, who dons a green eye shade, a couple of armbands, and a fluffy old silk shirt, and mans the telegraph at our, you know, Founders Day celebrations here in Pennsylvania. And people love it. You know, he sends on Sounders with American Morse. You know, it's quite the show to see that. And he transverts it over to a radio where it goes out on a radio link, and it's received by another member of the Morse Society, or I forget their exact name offhand. You know, but the kids love it. You know, and it's something we find that there's follow-up to. And so these are the things that we're trying to encourage. We're trying to develop new marketing materials to tell our story simply and easily, so that we don't leave people mystified by the hierarchical study of NETS. You know, we want graphical ways of doing this, you know, that people can, you know, look at and say, "Ah, I get it." You know, and you know, just very simple ways to get our message out there that's appealing to younger operators and their families, because that's another, you know, great recruiting tool that we think are not tapping effectively.
Well, we had I had a fellow on from the Morse Telegraph Club, and he was talking about the fact they have their own private network.
Yes, that would be them.
And they use Sounders and all that kind of stuff, and I thought that was so cool. And oddly enough, when we got to talking, I found out that a good portion of those fellows are not hams.
Right.
They're just telegraph operators, and they really enjoy doing just telegraph without the ham radio part of it. But you were talking about traditions, you know, and I guess the thing that kind of bothers me a little bit is I feel that we're missing, you know, I'll tell you, we're missing the traditional part of amateur radio from the standpoint of it being a legacy. We have people, you know, and I'm not going to get into this, but we've got people, well, I guess I am getting into it, but not in depth. People that are related to the league, that I've had is an interview that talk about Harvey Percy Maxim, you know, and I'm like, what? You know, it's like, come on. You know, here is this character. Now, you look at the picture of this guy, you know, and the picture. Yeah, it's striking. It, you know, and he was like the founder of it all. He was an inventor. He had patents on gun silencers and everything under the sun, and his call sign was W1AW, and he invented the Wolf Hung and the Ready Snitch, okay? And I've done radio shows with people that don't seem to understand. They do this Wolf Hung ceremony, and I you know, I've never been to one. I don't know if you have to be invited. I'm probably too big of a troublemaker to get invited to anything like that. But
well,
anyways,
I think you would be the natural recipient.
But anyways, what
it
I'm
is
saying,
an instrument of discipline.
You know, and I had a radio show cooked up. Here's what I was gonna do. I had it all figured out. Actually, I had recorded portions of it, and what it was, we were gonna look in on the shack of Joe Lidd, you know, and you know, he was going to be on the air, and these guys would be talking, and he'd jump in, and he'd make a noise or a sound or play a little bit of music or something over the radio, and he'd sit back and just laugh, you know, while these guys are saying, "Well, I'm sorry, I didn't get that. Somebody covered you over," you know. And he's playing around like this, and all of a sudden there's a knock at the door, you know, and he goes, "Oh, I wonder who is that?" And he gets to the door, and there's, you know, when he opens the door, he goes, "Oh, no! The Wolf Hung," you know, and then all of a sudden you hear this guy just screaming in pain, you know, while these guys are torturing him with this device. Now, I've looked very close at the Wolf Hung, and I cannot figure out how you would use it if you wanted to, but it sure looks evil, you know. But
it depends on waves through the ether. It's very,
you know,
technical.
Yeah, but then there's this thing called the Ready Snitch, which leaves nothing to the imagination, you know. But, you know, this is a part of I guess I want to say the heritage of ham radio.
Yes.
The fact that the guy wrote articles and signed them with the name The Old Man, okay? And, you know, it was like he was anonymous, but he could say things as the old man that he wouldn't normally be able to say. It reminds me when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I was sick in bed for about a year. And my dad had bought me one of these ventriloquist dummies. Right. And I continued working with this thing. Matter of fact, he went and got me a Frank Marshall doll. I don't know if you know what those are, but that's the same guy that built Jerry Mahoney for Paul Winchell. And I got good at this thing. And one thing I found that was really weird, and that is they would ask me to come into the classroom and to do a skit in front of the kids. And my mom was my writer, you know. And I would do the skit, but these kids would get mad at the dummy. I mean, the rough ones, the bullies, you know, the dummy would make a remark at them, and they'd come over and actually hit the dummy in the face, you know. So I guess what I'm saying is that the old man could say things that, you know, normally as Hiram Percy Maxim he couldn't say, and that was cool. See that, but I think a majority of people probably knew that the old man was him. Okay, but
sure.
But, you know, there was that tongue-in-cheek ability to be able to do that kind of thing.
And it's a wonderful American tradition. Of course, here in greater Philadelphia, you know, we are surrounded by the legacy of Benjamin Franklin. And, of course, he was Poor Richard, the poor orphan boy of his newspaper articles, who would say the same kind of things that no one else could say and get away with them because he was just a poor orphan boy. And the persona was able to inspire a generation of Americans eventually toward independence from the mother country. And Publius, with the Federalist Papers, who also took on a voice separate from the men who actually wrote their articles and argued persuasively for our constitutional system. Yes, it is a wonderful American system, and Hiram Percy Maxim comes from a family of larger-than-life characters. You know, he's a... His uncle, I believe, and his father were, you know, very highly respected men, recent immigrants to America themselves, and that was an age when larger than life was ordinary. And, you know, again, for, you know, a number of reasons, you know, just a great shift in our society, we did skip a lot of that over the last, you know, maybe 15, 20 years or so, when we were very forward-looking and looking to the future, and maybe dumping out that proverbial baby with the bathwater. But I see that trend turning around, Ted, and people are interested in what's old, and they want the best of it, you know, the stability that it brings, the surety that it brings. And when you combine that with a very progressive hobby like amateur radio, where you know, there's always something new and exciting, where you can make, you know, the discoveries and the you know, the engineering effort yourself and have something to show that you yourself have done, I think that's a powerful combination. And I think it speaks, honestly, it speaks to something that's uniquely American about us, with this opportunity but respect for the past and what it took to bring us here today. And I think that motivates a lot of us who have been in the amateur radio service for our lives. And I honestly have a...
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the QSL Radio Show. We'll be back with our guest, W3JY Joseph Ames, right after this. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you get a special bonus. Now, you be sure and do that. Check out this little radio, the SkyWave from the Sea Crane Company. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioShow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. And now, back to our guest, Joseph Ames, W3JY.
I can't imagine a better thing to do with my time, you know, and to teach my boys and my neighbors about, because it encapsulates all that's best about us in so many ways.
Well, you know, I guess I was going to say also, one thing that comes from all of this, not just a sense of humor, but it's a sense of vision.
Yes.
And I know at ARRL headquarters, there is an award sitting there on a shelf somewhere that Hiram Percy Maxim came up with for the first radio amateur that contacts Mars. Now, looking down the road a long ways, but think about it. We're not that far away from that.
No, we're not.
You know, a manned space flight to Mars, landing on the surface, and an amateur with some sort of, VHF rig, UHF rig, pointed back at planet Earth, and a contact is made, and that guy has just won himself the award, you know. Which, of course, if he, if he was in the spirit of it, he'd give it right back to the league with his name on it. But I see that vision, you know, and I guess I don't look at it like a lot of other folks do. I don't see that computers and internet and all that stuff has overshadowed amateur radio, because that same magic is still alive. If you watch kids, when you set them down and you start teaching them code, and you watch when you send something to them and they actually get it at the other end, man, I mean, it's like they light up. They become electrified, you know.
I love it.
And I think the problem is has not been what we have has lost its magic. I think the people that are in it have not made it their business to continue the magic. I don't know. Maybe I'm being too critical. But
I think you're right. And, you know, I think with the baby boom generation particularly, you know, they were more interested in living their lives in the moment than necessarily propagating it. But that's been recognized, and I think we're taking steps. For example, Joe Taylor, K1JT, the inventor of the WJST and JT65, used by NASA to communicate with our interstellar probes, recently gave a couple of talks. He went on a tour in southeastern Pennsylvania, and I think all the way up and down the coast, you know, taking time off of his, you know, very busy career at Princeton to explain just that. You know, how can we communicate with interstellar space probes, you know, and how does that work here on Earth, you know? And so there it is, you know, it's out there, it's being done, it resonates with people, particularly our youth, you know, who need a vision of the future that they can participate in and, you know, contribute and, you know, and claim as their own. And so yes, I think, you know, there were just simple societal disruptions that overshadowed things for a while. But I think amateur radio, particularly as a forward-looking, very dynamic and robust hobby, as well as a service, is adjusting to this. And I see it in my daily interactions, and I know you do. You know, we talked about the shortwave broadcast industry and the renaissance of shortwave listening. And, of course, you know, we haven't talked about the maker movement, which is right in the middle of this, and an offshoot for the RTL SDR aficionados with those little European terrestrial digital television receivers that are miniature software-defined receivers and can do all kinds of neat things with a couple of lines of code and a cable to connect it to your computer. We see a lot of people doing radio that never did radio. And I love reading their blogs because they're learning about Yagi antennas and decibels of signal strength and sources of interference and the need for filters on the front end and pre-selectors, yeah, and all the things necessary to make these radios and extract every bit of performance they can get out of this little $5 dongle that they plug into their laptops, you know. And it's a wonderful thing. They're very young. They're 20-somethings and teenagers. They carry it on. They have a vibrant community amongst themselves doing all kinds of neat stuff, and a lot of them become hams along with it. So,
well, we're at a broadcast site that where FM, commercial FM transmitters were working on something, and my son whips out this little, I don't know what it was, a little whatchamacallit, okay? And plugs it into the computer and tunes in the radio station, and it's actually a software-defined radio. But on the screen that is presented to us is a spectrum analyzer.
Yes.
And we can see everything that's going on. We can monitor the subcarrier, the bandwidth. We can see the iBox signal along with the analog signal.
Right.
I mean, all this stuff. And I think I said, where did you get this? You know, and he said, oh, I think it was like $50 somewhere. You know, it's like, and I was like, this is incredible, you know. I want to make a challenge here, though. I'm going to say that if the American Radio Relay League, of which I'm a member, okay, does not put more, you know, effort into recognizing the national traffic system, that I'm going to challenge them. They need to change their name from the American Radio Relay League to something else, okay? Because Relay League implies National Traffic System, folks. That's exactly what that name implies.
Yes, it does.
And I've heard people say, well, the league needs to change its name because it's outdated. No, it's not.
No.
They just need to recognize the basics of this, you know. So, and I can say that because, like I said, I'm a troublemaker, so I'm allowed to say that, you know. The thing I'd like to ask too, just a couple questions, and I don't want to wear this subject out, so to speak. But okay, these nets that you were talking about that are for folks that may want to monitor this and listen to this, how do you find the like, say for example, the 4RN whatever? I guess that's one of the what is that? Tell me what that is. 4RN. What is that again? You had a name for it.
Well, there are two fourth region nets. There's what we call internally cycle 2, which would be the morning or daytime, and then cycle 4, which is the evening.
Region nets, okay.
Yes, a region net. Third, the fourth region net. And at ARRL.org, in fact, I'll look it up. I think it's under their little operating header. Or if you just type in nets in their keyword search box, it will take you to the net listings page. And you can search that to your heart's content. It's a little bit of a kludgy search engine for people accustomed to the, you know, nice Google kind of search. You know, it's more of an old-fashioned computer search, but it gets the job done. And you can do it by region or state and a couple of other different selectors on there. The other thing you may want to do is just go to Google and you know, Google National Traffic Nets, and many pages will come up. Many sections have wonderful section web pages that just give all kinds of fantastic information on the nets, how to operate them, what a radiogram is, training videos, training software, and presentations and proposals that are out there. There's a ton of stuff, and you know, Ted, you're absolutely right, because we don't tell anybody this stuff is here, and it's like the best kept secret in all of amateur radio, but it is there. And I'm going to accept your challenge, because I am an official of the league and a life member, and I agree with you that we need to promote the national traffic system more, and that's my mission, at least as long as my colleagues will have me here doing my bit to make trouble on behalf of the NTS.
Well, you know, local clubs, I mean, this is something that's lost, and that is, I remember the first time I looked at a radiogram, and I said, what do I do with this? You know, how does this work, you know? And it was intimidating, because I thought, I don't want to get on here and screw up. You know, I don't want to take a message and not, you know, and not be able to articulate on the air what it was I'm doing and be in compliance with the format, you know, because it's like, if I get in here now and I say, okay, I can take this, you know, I'm going to look like a buffoon.
Let me allay that concern for you and anyone listening who's interested. Just today, a couple of hours ago, I'm looking at, came through commercial email, but at 6 o'clock this evening, I had a very nice message from a deacon in a church in Philadelphia who is taking the ARRL Emergency Communications 1 course, and as part of that course, he needs to learn how to originate and transmit a radiogram, and so he formatted one using a PDF form that's out there online. They're all over the place. And he emailed it to me, which we're cool with, because we'll take radiograms no matter how we get them. You know, we're communicators, you know, at heart. But he's sending it to his goddaughter, who's just a teenage girl in Philadelphia. And so we put that into the system. We put that on the National Traffic System digital network, where it went to a fella who's in Metro Philly, who just loves delivering these things. And his goddaughter will get it tomorrow, and it'll be a great thrill for her. And here's this man who's a grandfather, and you know, he's learning how to do it, and he's introducing, you know, his granddaughter to it. And so it's just it is out there, it's being done, and we like to think it's like the cranberry people. You know, we're going to sell these one radiogram can at a time.
Yeah, and you know what? She's going to get that, and that's going to arouse her curiosity. What is this? You know,
yes.
What exactly is this? You know, and it'd be wonderful if there was someone there, whoever delivers it, who can explain that and say, this is a radiogram, you know.
Yes.
And would you like to send one back?
Yes. And I have a good idea who the delivery operator will be, and I have every confidence he's going to do just that. And we hope that the girl will then take her tablet, which is connected to their broadband end connection, and Google radiograms, and take off from there too. So
there you go. Now let me just I guess I want to say move into a slightly different area. You are active, very active in ARES and RACES.
Yes.
Okay, and that's what, in Delaware?
In eastern Pennsylvania.
Okay, eastern Pennsylvania. So I guess I want to say, I want to ask, what is it exactly in ARES and RACES that you do? And kind of explain that with in mind that we have a lot of newbies listening that are curious about this. And Like, what is the difference between these two organizations, and how could I get involved in one?
Right, right. Well, it's a very pertinent question, and in fact, this is a good time to answer it. ARES is a program of the American Radio Relay League. It stands for the Amateur Radio Emergency Service. It dates back to the early 1930s when it was called the ARRL Emergency Corps. And it was seen as a civilian but almost paramilitary in its discipline corps of trained operators that would get out there in a disaster and man the radios to get vital information to headquarters. And over the years, the program has grown. It has partnered with the professional emergency managers by way of the civil defense authorities during the Cold War. In many ways, it's an outgrowth of the World War II era war emergency radio service and the old white hats, you know, the neighborhood air wardens and that sort of thing. It essentially is designed to respond where radio would be needful at a local level. And in that regard, the ARES is a very local-centric, very community-centric program. Now, along with that, you usually see ARES races, and I am also something of a historian of George Hart, you know, the former communications manager for the league, and he tells a funny story about this. He actually was the guiding force behind the establishment of the Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, specifically to perpetuate amateur radio during a war, as the War Emergency Radio Service did. And he tells in one of his memoirs that was printed in QST that, of course, the ARRL and he wrote all the regulations for it, and at the last minute, the Pentagon decided that the ARRL would not administer the program, the Pentagon would, as part of civilian defense. And he was, of course, upset at that, but glad that his program would take root and grow. But at the same time, he said, we spent about 2 years with many marketing consultants and many thousands of ideas trying to find a good name for it. He said, we finally found a name that was easily recognizable, easy to pronounce, sounded well on the radio. And even now, within 2 months of its introduction, it's mispronounced not races, but races. And it was meant to be races, like down to the races. So, funny story from George Hart.
But I say, I've always said Racy's because everybody else has always said Racy's.
And they've done that from the very beginning of it in 1952 when it was first instituted.
It's something else I want to put to rest here, if I can. This is an inappropriate comment at the wrong time, okay? Really good at this. The old man, Hiram Percy Maxim, would sign his letters and memoirs and stuff 73s,
yeah.
Plural, okay? So all of you curmudgeons out there that yell at young people and you say, it's not 73s, it's 73. Okay, well, go back and talk to Hiram about that, okay? Let's just go back to the brass tacks. He signed his stuff 73s, and I've heard that all my life, you know, and every once in a while, I run into one of these curmudgeons. Well, 73. You're incorrect, young man. It should be 73. Where do you come up with this 73s? Well, I got it from Hiram Percy Maxim, okay? All right, let's move on. Back to our...
I think that must be his version of Philadelphia's, hey, you guys.
exactly what it is.
It's the plural version of 73 when it's sent to an audience, so there.
So now, okay. Races. I've got to change the way I say this now.
Races is actually a radio regulation that lives in FCC Part 97. At one point, it was part of the Civil Defense Code, Title 12, if I have that correct. And please don't quote me on the numbers. I have a memory like the proverbial steel sieve. But it was incorporated into the Part 97 at some point in the 1970s for various reasons. And its sole purpose was to allow existing amateur radio licensees to operate their equipment for the benefit of civil defense if the president invoked his war powers authority or if war was declared by Congress and radio silence was imposed upon the country. That is its purpose. And it was designed to facilitate communications between the civil defense bunkers in the bottom of the courthouse. Remember the old Gonsa sets there with their bright yellow, you know, and state and military installations that would use it to get vital ground truth to and from communities and the command post, whatever it might be. And this was also understood to be applicable to natural disasters as well as military invasions and threats of invasions. And for the longest time under the Cold War, there was a races organization that was called Civil Defense, and you would sign up on it. I have the organizing papers for the Carbon County, Pennsylvania Civil Defense Races Network, and it was signed by the Civil Defense Director and the Civil Defense Council for that part of Pennsylvania. It involved a number of hand-picked operators. They were recommended for their operating skill and their patriotism. They had to undergo an FBI check. They didn't call it a background check at the time, but you know, a check of their character and interview their neighbors. They had to swear a loyalty oath to do this, that they would they recognized that this contained national defense implications and that violation of this oath was considered an act of treason against the United States. It was very serious business. Of course, what happened is that the civil defense model became FEMA right around the time of Three Mile Island, if you remember there in 1978-ish. And FEMA elected not to pick up the civil defense organization. Instead, they adopted the emergency management concept. And what happened is that all these county civil defense organizations that had wonderful relations with their radio guys, which is almost always how they were called, most of whom were league members and members of their local ARES, Amateur Radio Emergency Service, didn't know what to do with it. There was no longer a federal coordinating entity behind it. There was no longer a promulgational authority, if you will. So what they did was continue the old program on a local basis. And that has persisted until very recently. And recently, of course, they've changed their thinking again on this, and they have what they call the Auxiliary Communication Service, and it's a more comprehensive way of doing this, but it's considered to be a coordinating activity, because what everyone has finally come to realize is there's no such thing as a races organization. There are county radio auxiliaries. Most of them are actually the league's ARES groups that use that serve the county government as their served agency in much the same way that they've done since 1934 when it was first inaugurated. And so a lot of the old confusion is out there, probably from the same curmudgeons who forbid 73s. You know, and they're just remembering, they have this vivid memory of 1956 with their white helmet. Maybe their father had it, and I think that's really what it amounts to. So today there's much more clarity. In fact, a gentleman from the Department of Homeland Security's National Communications Infrastructure Group wrote a beautiful essay that comprises the entirety of the second chapter of the current version of the ARES manual that was just published by the League. And it explains all this, and it was a wonderful thing. My radio mentor out here is an attorney, a K3RF, Bob Famiglio, who's a also a vice director of the League. He's also an attorney that practices in the radio and broadcast space. And he has educated me extensively on what races really is and how it's a set of regulations to facilitate other organizations to communicate, primarily ARES. And this new manual that's been published by the League dedicates an entire chapter to that concept. And so essentially what we're looking at today is that ARES is the number one predominant single greatest entity for amateur radio emergency response. There's an analog in Canada, so it's continental wide. And even though they work primarily with their local counties, that there's a recognition there too that this needs to be reintegrated. We speak of the reintegration of ARES and NTS, and so there's a lot more work on that regard. They're becoming much more popular with governments even than they were in the aftermath of 9/11, when a lot of money was thrown at them because of budget crunches that exist today. State budgets are pressed, county budgets are pressed in New England, where they don't use counties anymore, and the towns, their budgets are squeezed, and they realize But they have this cadre of operators, right out of our Part 97 preamble, by the way, you know, who are there, you know, volunteers, you're forbidden from charging money for these services, and they know an awful lot about it. And so there's no need for a government agency or even, you know, the Red Cross to reinvent the wheel. They can partner with our guys, basically, which, you know, for all intents and purposes here means an ARIES group that's already out there, you know, and has their act together, and they train, and they know all the local EMA people and the fire, you know, the firemen and the volunteers in their localities, you know, and they have that community that we're talking about before. It's a very close-knit group, as it turns out, in many places, and we're very glad to have them, and we're very excited on working with the NTS as we you know, reestablish the long lines capability, you know, for our local groups, and there's a lot of work being done on that nationally. Again, you know, the league has you know, a traditional kind of hands-off, you know, approach to this, which, you know, makes sense given, you know, they have many often conflicting mandates. But it's up to the initiative of people like us, you know, to make that happen, and it's happening. So we're very glad about that. And I guess that's probably the, you know, the basics of what's going on with ARIES and races and how they go out.
Well, I wanna do two things here. I wanna ask you about two things before we run out of time here. The first thing is, I noticed that you're a member of the Quarter Century Wireless Association.
Yes, I am.
And we've never talked about this on QSO. Why don't you kind of give the folks a little bit of a rundown on what that is and how a person might become a member of QCWA?
Well, that's a great question. And QCWA is for all those hams that make it 25 years. And that's the sole requirement for membership. And they meet in various towns and cities all across the United States, chapters. And, you know, the chapters, you know, have many activities from breakfasts and suppers and even on-air nets. And if you stroll the upper end of 80 meters on a Saturday morning, you'll probably find a handful of QCWA nets that are operating. And, yeah, it's a fun group. And I joined it the very day I was eligible. I had my application in the mail because that's how we did it with mail back then.
There you go. Okay. Well, I wanted you to... So anybody that's been active for 25 years...
That's correct.
...can become a QCWA member.
Quarter Century Wireless Association. That's right.
Now, the next thing I want to ask you about, and that is, when in your life did you ever first hear the term ham radio?
Well, I heard it from my father. My father helped introduce me to it, as a matter of fact. And he grew up with the old shortwave radios, the old wonderful tube console radios. You know, he was a child of the Depression. And they would listen to war news coming from Europe on there. And after the war, of course, you know, you turn the bands a little bit more and you hear all the ham activity. And my father was never a ham. He was a chef, so he was more interested in a different kind of ham when it crossed his mind, I guess. But he wanted his boys to be involved in technology, and he steered us to it. And I remember vividly, we had recently moved back to Pennsylvania, where I was born, in Philadelphia, and we visited the wonderful Franklin Institute right here in Center City off the Ben Franklin Parkway. And it's the National Ben Franklin Shrine, and it's a science center. And for years and years and years, W3AA was the ham radio station there. And it had a beautiful location on the first floor, not far from the entrance, near some very popular exhibits. And the CB craze was very big. And I was a shortwave listener. We had recently moved from Minnesota, the frozen tundra of Minneapolis, where the winter is the best 9 months of the year. And my father had given me a multi-band radio that had shortwave on it. And so I had spent years there, snowed in, you know, listening to Radio Moscow, the Voice of America, Radio Kiev, Radio Cuba, Radio France International, the BBC, you know, Radio Sweden, all those wonderful programs, you know, programs from shows I'd never, you know, languages I couldn't understand, but were from the Caribbean or, you know, Africa. And so it was only natural that he would take it to the next step, you know, from shortwave listening and CB. So we went to the Franklin Institute and toured that, and he struck up a conversation with the ham who was manning the station that day, and he got a contact name for the guy who became my ham radio mentor eventually, Carl Feil, who's a wonderful man, a veteran of World War II with the FCC, of all things, W3VA in Tamaqua, Pennsylvania. It was the nearest city to where we lived there in the boondocks. And Dad drove me to their club meetings and to the novice license courses. For those listening, the novice license, novice meaning newbie in Latin, you know, is the way you got into ham radio back then, and it was terrifying and thrilling and exciting that I and my buddy Rick, he was WB3JZA, and I ended up being WB3JYZ, and that we'd be able to talk to each other on the same radios that we had spent the last couple of years listening to all these stations. Everything that was going on, you know, WWV. You know,
well, did you have a period of time at all, though, when you were on Citizens Band?
Not me personally, but my father used it in the car. He drove a lot. He was in sales at that point, technical sales, so he'd go back and forth to accounts that were all over the country. And that CB, I'll tell you, was a literal lifesaver during one ice storm when the hill got shut down and he was stuck in traffic. He was able to call for help. And I think that's really what cinched him on the value of having radio, and especially ham radio, because it turned out the CB-er that relayed his call was also a ham. And you know, he never forgot that.
Well, there's two things that I think we need right now. You know, and you're okay, you're one of these ARRL guys. Okay, so anyhow, yeah, I'm a league member, so I mean, troublemaker, I can say these things. I think we need a portion of maybe two of the bands, maybe 80 and 40, where they assign an area on that band for super, super slow CW. Now, what I mean by that is this. Years ago, we had to pay, in order to get your novice license, you had to do 5 words a minute.
Right.
You could run 75 watts. You were crystal controlled. And you operated, 80 meters, 3,700 to 3,750. There was just that little sliver on the dial. But that's all you needed. I mean, it was really a lot of fun. Oh, man, you could collect QSL cards and everything. Anyhow, but what I'm thinking is today, and that is people no longer learn 5 words a minute and then pass the test to get on the air. A lot of these folks are trying to learn on the air. So they're starting from ground zero. So there should be a little sliver somewhere on the dial, I think, on 80 and 40, where people can get on and they can work at 3 words a minute, if that's what it takes. Okay? And
I agree with you.
We've got so many of these speed demons that get on, and I hear these guys going QRO, QRO, and the guy still comes back at 20 words a minute. If he was around me, I'd want to throw something at him. You know?
Yeah.
Let's learn the code, but there ought to be a place like that so that, you know, the guys that want to run 20 words a minute, let them get the heck out of Dodge. Let them stay away from that little sliver on the dial, okay?
Right.
The next thing I think we need to do, or what needs to be done, is I think that amateurs ought to be able to get on Citizens Band using their call signs. And help mentor some of the people, and I mean, I know there's some unsavory bunch on there, but there's still that interconnection that you could gain with amateur radio and the Citizens Band operators. And I'm talking about the genuine ones that really and truly, love radio. During emergency situations, that could be invaluable. Where hams could communicate. I know a ham could put a rig in his house and use a handle and all that. But what a better way to actually promote the hobby of being able to get on Channel 19 or whatever it is and use your ham call sign.
Well, you know, CB has had something of a renaissance itself, and of course, you know, again, you know, we old timers know this, but the noobs won't. The CB 11 meter band used to be a ham radio assignment, so there's a historical precedent for what you're suggesting there. And
my old Globe Champ 300 had 11 meters on it.
That's right. We won our band back. But, you know, I think, you know, maybe one of the advantages of our present age where we had that break with the past is that, some of the proposed rulemakings I've seen and some of the conversations, we just run across here in the NPS and things that are going on even with the league where they're proposing opening up HF frequencies to technician class operators who run digital, which is fine with me because it gets them on HF and then they can do this, you know, they have a station that'll do it. But I think there's a willingness to examine ideas that would at one time have seemed, you know, insanely radical. We're beginning to understand that there's a radio confraternity, and that there's incredible pressure from commercial interests and even you know, military and government interests who've discovered that, you know, HF is a pretty neat little natural phenomenon, and, you know, we want our chunk of it. And these guys, you know, they're not, there's no value proposition behind them that can be quantified by net present value and, you know, discount calculation. So why aren't we there? And this is the kind of thinking that could help, maybe reinvigorate radio, you know, for the 21st century. So, yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying there, Ted. It's a creative way of looking at it. You know, it brings radio men together, no matter what, you know, distinctions may have artificially separated us. I think at this point, it's the love of radio, you know, of infrastructureless communications from point A to point B, almost by magic. And that's really the thing about radio, no matter how you're doing it.
I could imagine seeing, you know, code practice being done on 11 meters, back and forth teaching fellows at code. But, I mean, of course, at that point, they're more interested in just getting the technician license. But right. I don't know. It just seems like that interconnection. Of course, I came up through Citizens Band. I mean, that was one of the very first things that I got into as a kid. And just recently, I purchased an old Knight 2590. 8-channel transmit, 23-channel receive. It doesn't work, but that's the radio I started with. So I had to have one in the shack just to have it sitting there, you know.
A little deoxit and a recap. Probably take care of that, too.
Yeah, but, of course, I'd never have time to operate it. That's the only problem. I don't have time to operate the regular bands. But, you know, this is so cool to see that your dad, you know, gave you a shortwave receiver or a multiband radio. And I remember an old Cathedral Gruno that I had, and I don't know, I listened, I remember hearing them come on and say, from the island of the flamingos,
and
they play the sound of these birds. This is Trans World Radio, Netherlands Antilles. I remember that very, very well. And, you know, and of course, HCJB at Quito, Ecuador.
Quito, Ecuador, of course.
And the DX mailbag programs and things. They had all kinds of stuff on these stations. It was so cool. And we're trying to duplicate some of that right now on WTWW. We want to try to bring some of that back so folks have something to tune in and really enjoy listening to their shortwave radio or even tuning their ham rig down and being able to listen to that, as well as these little portables like this Skywave that Sea Crane is making is just incredible. But this is so cool because I remember the ham band on these shortwave rigs was about an eighth of an inch wide.
There's a lot out there, apart from us.
And of course, most of those operators, the only ones we could hear, were the AM guys, and they'd be sitting talking, and typically very long-winded. I don't know if you remember that.
I think they're still on there after midnight, yeah.
But, you know, this has been interesting, and we're out of time, but here's what I want you to do, if you would. If you would, please tell our listeners, especially the newbies, what you would suggest right now for them to do in order to get involved in the national traffic system, or how to, and yeah, we are out of time. If you could just give us a brief location, where can they go on the web to look and where can they listen?
Google National Traffic System, and the first one that will come up will be an independent web page with a wiki with contact information. And in fact, we have a wonderful newsletter called QNI. I'm gonna do this right now. Give me 1 second. You know, I should have had this up. But Jim Wade's out of Michigan. He's the manager of the Michigan Net. Publishes an independent newsletter called QNI for the Q signal for checking into a radio net. And where is it here? By golly. QNI-NTS.org. QNI-NTS.org will take you to the webpage for the QNI newsletter by Jim Wades, WB8SIW, and it will have contact information. It will have wonderful newsletters about the national traffic system, where it's going, where it's been, what we're doing now. And barring that, just send me an email to w3jy@arrl.org. That's w3jy@arrl.org, and I'll steer you in the right direction.
I want to thank you for joining us, and we're going to have you back. You know, you and I could talk for the rest of the night.
You're wonderful conversation. Thank you so very much for having me.
Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. Please tune us in again next week, same time, same station, for the QSO Radio Show.